Hello and welcome to Rocket Talk. I'm your host, Justin Landon, and today I'm joined by fantasy author Daniel Polansky. Daniel is the author of four novels, including The Straight Razor Cure, Tomorrow the Killing, and She Who Waits, which complete the Lowtown trilogy. His newest novel is called Those Above. Born in Baltimore, Daniel makes his home in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks so much for having me, Justin.
On this Sunday morning where it's deathly cold where you're at, and I'm dodging church, which is great. I was on Twitter the other day, and I saw that you had a little writing liaison with Mike Cole. Who paid? I mean, did you open the door for him? Like, what went down?
I mean, Mike tries to pay for everything, because he's just got to walk around wearing his paladin badge on the front of his shirt. But normally, like, I manage to sort of, intercept the check often enough that, like, I don't feel terrible about it.
He's so nice, you know. What do you do on a writing date? Do you sit there and write with your headphones on, or do you, like, write each other's books?
Like, most of my time with Mike is just, like, spent acting as, like, sort of a backstop psychiatrist. So it'll be, like, an hour of listening to, like, Mike Cole's, you know, like, sort of morbid despair. And then I'll be like, okay, but, you know, actually your life is fine, and, like, we need to get back on track. And then we just kind of write drunkenly, and he complains every so often.
Okay. All right. So, you know, it sounds sort of like basically like you're writing separately and on Twitter, but you're just doing that in person.
He likes to have, like, people around him when he writes. He likes the sort of group dynamic. I just generally am set up in bars, like, drinking and writing, and I'm always happy to have someone come by.
The whole notion of going out to write fascinates me. I mean, it's sort of like you're paying somebody else to help you write. Like, you have to pay the bar or the coffee shop. I mean, you could just write at home and it would be free.
Yeah, I suppose. But, I mean, you know, one, like, I mean, I do this full time. This has been full time for, like, going on 5 years. So if I just was inside all day, I'd be going mad. Plus, I mean, I'm paying the bar for beer, Justin. I mean, I'm not just, like, hanging around. They do give me things to drink. So, you know, there's some legitimate quid pro quo there.
You don't actually rent the stool. It should be like a writer's bar where you sort of rent, you know, your stool, and you can just have that for a while. That'd be, you know.
You can rent, you know, like, space in sort of writer's workshop type places, but I really don't like other writers, except for, you know, like, a handful of people, so that never really appealed to me, to be honest.
You have a new book coming out in, you know, about 11 days from the time of this recording. It'll be, you know, less than that when people are actually listening to it, and it's called Those Above. Now, you don't have a U.S. publisher yet, so this is coming out in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I mean, it should be available in the U.S. in the not-too-distant future. There's, you know, we're going to arrange something. But at the moment, it'll be, you know, if you're listening to this and you're speaking, you know, like, in a sort of slightly off-keel accent, or, like, you know, you're saluting, you know, the Queen Mom or something like that, then you can totally go out and buy it, and I very much hope you do.
You wrote a three-book series, which is the Lowtown series, and now you've got Those Above, so you're actually breaking away from the first trilogy, right, instead of just continuing on into this endless spiral of continuing sequels?
Right, yes. The Lowtown stuff, they're unrelated to the two. It's in a different world. I guess that's my coffee maker boiling in the background. I'm sorry if that's coming in. It's a lot louder than I've thought of before. You know, it's a new world. It's a new series. I guess, you know, for me personally, as much as I enjoyed writing The Warden and the whole Lowtown thing, and I got a big kick out of it, you know, I sort of felt like there was only so much you can do with anything, and I kind of reached the point of self-parody, and maybe it was time to tie the whole thing up in a neat little bow. So Those Above is I think, very different, although you always have a weird view on it from within your own writing.
Well, certainly from a tone perspective, it's a lot different. For those that don't know, the Lowtown series was written in a first person. It's all about the warden, right? It's about his story. And now in Those Above, you're focusing on something, I mean, for lack of a better term, it seems a lot grander. It's actually sort of an epic fantasy as opposed to a not epic fantasy. More traditional fantasy story, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a funny thing, and now that, you know, obviously as the book comes out, you know, it ends up sort of being a taunt. You end up reflecting a lot on your sort of motivations, you know, years earlier for starting to write it. I guess this is going to sound a little silly, you know. I think I sort of initially was trying to set out to do something a little more, like, consciously in keeping with the sort of movement of the genre. But then it sort of ended up going in a completely different direction, and I'm not sure how the thing exactly ended up. I mean, I definitely wanted to try something new. You know, I felt like I had the Warden's kind of tone of voice down pretty narrowly already, and wasn't as you know, didn't want to keep going through the same motions as far as that went. And then also, you know, there were a lot of things I guess I was more interested in sort of world building and in sort of, I mean, it is definitely a grander story. The challenge, I suppose, I like the idea of doing something different, than doing something that I hadn't already done, and maybe, you know, seeing if I could accomplish it to any level of success.
It's funny because when I read The Straight Razor Cure, which in the United States was just known as Lowtown, which is, by the way, the worst titling decision in the history of titling decisions.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been a good idea, but at least the cover. Good, so that helped.
Yeah, right. But The Straight Razor Cure, when I read that book, I actually felt like you were building towards something very epic, right? Because you have a lot of hints in that book about a wider world, and the Warden goes into these flashbacks, and you see sort of this major war conflict, and then you pulled it back in the second and third books back more intimate, like you didn't expand the scope of the story. Was there a time when you had considered making that series grander and pulled it back, or was it always intended to be this really tight journey?
It's really a funny thing how the way other people sort of read and see your books. For me, like, the Lowtown stuff was always basically just about the Warden and like this attempt to sort of do something with his this particular viewpoint and this particular kind of character. I never had any intention of him leaving the city or anything like that. It was about sort of his moral decay and like the decay of this particular kind of urban center. Yeah, I mean, to be absolutely honest, like the world beyond that, you know, is pretty slapdash. I mean, if you were like take a stroll through Lowtown, you'd start seeing the struts pretty quickly once you passed, you know, outside of the slums.
It's like the first person video game where you're like walking around and like, so you can go into a glitched area.
There's like barricades up, and it's like, sorry, sir, there's an accident right now. You can't go into the main part of the city.
You and I have had various conversations over the years. I know that your reading and your sort of background in reading and writing is not 100% genre based. You read voraciously outside of the genre, but you've chosen to write extremely genre-y. Why do you write exclusively in genre when you do so much outside of the genres personally?
Well, first, I mean, I have read a lot of genre stuff, and I think I used to read a lot more. I think sort of paradoxically, when I became a writer, when this became like a career for me, I don't know, I guess other genre writers don't feel this way, but to me it's like a very odd thing to read something in a style relatively similar to what I'm working in. It's hard for me to detach myself, like, from the writer part of me to kind of walk off the set and leave the reader part of me to just enjoy it. And I guess I feel like I'm you know, like a professional magician going to a stage show and like pointing at the hand hidden behind the cloth or whatever. So I tend to feel like everything I read, you know, in weird ways ends up informing hopefully what you're writing.
Clearly in the first series, you took sort of a fantasy milieu and sort of jammed it together with a crime novel, and that was what you got, right? Was the Lowtown series.
Yes, right.
Is this something that you maybe did in those above as well, or is it more...
Yeah, I mean, I think those above, I mean, the Lowtown stuff, the influences are like really obvious, you know, I mean, it's written in a very deliberate, you know, it's like a haiku, it's a variation on a form, you know, with that hard boiled, you know, first person kind of narration and the really kind of nasty dialogue. And those above, I mean, the influences are a little subtler. You know, for instance, I mean, a lot of those above is about the world building and is about these sort of grander thematic notions that I'm trying to talk about in terms of like the movement of history and the corruption of empire and decadence and expansion and real politik and these kinds of things. So in that sense, I mean, a lot of it really comes from, you know, probably my longtime kind of obsession with history and with particularly like military history, essentially. as my editor is fond of observing, I sort of came up with the idea for Those Above, or at least I pitched them the idea for Those Above, when I was reading Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire like a year or two back. And you know, so in that sense, I mean, not necessarily quite as much in the sort of in terms of the language and the sort of style of the writing, but in terms of the sort of broader thinking, you know, I mean, it's definitely cribbed from a lot of that kind of thing.
I know you're buddies with John Horner Jacobs. When I hear you've been reading Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, I feel like you and John are probably exchanging notes about Roman formations or something.
You know, in terms of like narrow military history things, Mike Cole is the one again who will often, you know, yell at me that he's fought in a phalanx and I never have. which is a long running point of dispute between us, because he hasn't fought in a phalanx. He's fought in like a foam rubber phalanx, which I don't think counts. But we have a dispute over this matter. I love John's great. He's an awesome dude. I didn't know that he was into Roman stuff. I'll have to holler at him. We're about a million miles away from each other, and he, like you, Justin, has a real life and a job and like a family. And so sometimes I'll tweet at him, and he'll be like, you know, adults aren't up this late, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's, you know, this is the life of a fantasy author who writes full time, right? I mean, you don't have any connection with reality in a lot of
ways. It's a slim tether, man. I'll be real blunt with you. When they institutionalize me and you don't get no one gets a follow up to Those Above, like, at least you'll understand why.
Whoa, hey, shots fired here. Daniel Polansky will write a sequel to Those Above.
Right, no, I will, and I won't be institutionalized. I'm in perfect mental health, and the sequel is coming very well.
Hotter called their attorneys.
Right, no, it's coming. I swear it's coming. As soon as this interview is done, I'm going to get back to writing.
You've had some travails with your United States distribution, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Sure, yeah.
The first book, Lowtown, was highly publicized, I guess you could say, at least in certain circles, mm-hmm. and was mm-hmm. well read within our insular online community, that who knows right. how big or influential it may be, but it was well reviewed and well liked, and it was put out by Doubleday. Mm-hmm. And then your second and third books did not come out.
No, that's true. Well, they have now, but it took about 3 or 4 years, depending how you look at it. It's a little complicated, but they got put out through the U.S. distribution arm of my U.K. publisher, the lovely people over
there. Excellent.
But you can buy them now, and you know, I would plead despairingly with your readers to run out and do so, because they're not altogether not worth reading.
That was a very convoluted way of saying they're quite good.
Yeah. Well, I'll leave that to you to say it then.
Well, no, but you actually said it. You just said it.
No, I don't know. Justin, you just said it. You just said they were really good. That was I think we're recording this, right? So there's evidence right there.
And it's been kind of an interesting journey for you. I mean, I think when Lowtown came out, there was sort of this expectation and your name started getting handed around in certain conversations, right? Like, oh, you know, there's this new author, Daniel Polansky. He's kind of this new hot debut writer. Some of that momentum was lost during all of this. Would you agree?
That would be indisputable, yeah. I mean, you know, the short of it is, yeah, everything you said basically is true. It seemed like my name was tipped to be, you know, sort of a rising star within the genre. The book was all reviewed and people seemed to like it, but unfortunately people didn't really seem to buy it, in the U.S. at least. So, you know, that definitely sort of set it back a few years.
Well, and I think that speaks a little bit to kind of what I was hinting at a minute ago of, like, we have this super knowledgeable online community that finds books and reads them and then talks about them and reviews them and pushes them within the community. But we forget sometimes that there's this whole other side of bookselling.
You know, there's the old William Goldman line. He was the scriptwriter for Marathon Man and Princess Bride and about a million other things. And he wrote a famous sort of novel, a thing in the 70s about how stupid Hollywood is, basically. And his line was, no one knows anything. And I think that generally applies to publishing as well. I mean, there's just some things seem to hit and then some things kind of don't. Yeah, for whatever reason, like, people who read Lowtown seem to like it. But, you know, it never really expanded beyond a wider audience of, like, bloggers and writers. So like when I go to conventions, people will be like, oh, I know who you are. And like other writers know who I am, but no actual people. So hopefully that'll change. But, you know, what can you do?
Shots fired. Bloggers and writers, not real people. I like it. It's kind of true. I mean, I'm not saying it's not true. It's actually rather insightful. And so the other big news that kind of came out this week is that you are one of the first writers to sell a novella to the Tor.com imprint. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you. And congratulations to you as well, because Justin is being too polite to mention that he's an integral part of this process. And actually, he was the one who picked up my book, or the novella, excuse me.
Yeah, no, I'm apparently the editor for the book. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun because it's a very interesting new old thing that's being put up here by Tor.com, which is that the self-publishing certainly has brought attention to different lengths of fiction, I think. And we've seen some success with a lot of self-published shorter novels or novellas or serials. You know, obviously Hugh Howey being a great example of somebody who put out short work and was hugely successful with it. And so I'd be very interested to see how this all plays out, but I think it's all tied to the fact that novellas and short novels used to be like the sex in the old days. Right? I mean, you're a connoisseur of literature. When did we get bogged down with doorstoppers and why?
To be absolutely honest, there are levels of this question that I can't meaningfully answer. Certainly in terms of the genre, it seems like this sort of maximalist kind of position came into vogue, where it was like no one really wants to read a book unless they know there are 18 follow-up books to it, which I think is really too bad of a thing. I mean, from my perspective, I'm really thrilled. As a writer, I'm really thrilled about this Tor.com thing, because I think novellas are really cool. It's a really cool way to tell a story. This novella we're working on, The Builders, is this idea that I've had for years and really loved, and like thought it was funny and kind of a weird sort of fun mashup of like a children's book and like a really violent sort of crime western. But I also felt like there was never going to be any way it would be released, because there isn't really, honestly, outside of what you guys are doing, I don't even know how one releases a novella. Like, unless you're Stephen King or something, and you can just say, I have three novellas that you want to release, and you do what I fucking tell you because I'm Stephen King. Yeah, like I don't know what the format is. I don't know how one buys a novella. I haven't bought a novella from anyone, you know, as long as I can remember, outside of like large anthologies or whatever. So I think it's really cool. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, up until now, I think the novella market was essentially restricted to Subterranean Press, if you are big enough to have Subterranean Press want to publish one of your novellas, which again is like Joe Lansdale, Stephen King, or you were in an anthology. That's exactly right. I mean, because most magazines now, they don't want to publish novellas. They don't have space for those.
Obviously, there was a time in America where like people read a lot of these sort of literary magazines. I mean, even within the genre, you had all of these Amazing Tales or these kinds of different things. Although honestly, like none of those have existed in my lifetime or not really, at least I can't ever remember reading any of them, which really is too bad, because I think short stories are great and novellas are great, and you can do a lot of really cool things with them. And in fact, I have a lot of like very memorable kind of novellas that I can think of reading that were just like strange and distinct in some fashion. You know, the truth is there's just a lot of ideas that are perfect for about 30,000 words, but you can't conceivably stretch them to 80. You know, they're just not enough to do more than like one shot with. So I'm really excited about this. I hope people take a look at it.
You mentioned sort of briefly what the novella is, which is it's, I don't know, I've called it Redwall Goes Grimdark, maybe.
Right. I pitched originally as Wind in the Willows Meets the Wild Bunch, but maybe neither of those are well known enough for that to be relevant.
Or the Dirty Dozen, which is basically the Wild Bunch. The Dirty Dozen meets Watership Down, maybe.
Exactly. Something like that. I guess Seven Samurai invented it. If there's an earlier kind of stage of it, I don't know what it is. But, you know, it's that kind of classic, like, we've got to get a group of hard men together for a nasty kind of a mission. Except in this case, the men are woodland creatures. And the mission is like overthrowing the sort of current king. But it was a ton of fun to write. I got started on The Builders like 5 years ago. I can remember writing it at this temp job that I had just before Lowtown got picked up. And like knowing I should start working on the sequel to Lowtown, but just like thinking this idea was so funny and just like really enjoying writing about animals killing each other, which probably doesn't say great things about me, but there we are.
Right, but you weren't writing yourself killing the animals, which makes it right. Totally fine. I mean, you.
Right, I don't. The animals are killing each other. I don't. I've never. I ran over a raccoon once, but it was unintentional, and I felt bad about it afterwards.
Yeah, it makes you a good person. You mentioned that you really had no concept whether this would ever get published or not, or probably had the assumption that maybe it wouldn't be. You've never published anything else but novels, right? You've never published short fiction.
No. I mean, I guess I published a few before. I mean, before I sold Lowtown, I wrote like some travel essays and a few things like that. But fiction wise, no, I don't think I ever really have. Although, I mean, I write a lot of stuff that I just don't. The truth is, I'm the world's like worst damn self promoter, and the only reason this happened at all really is I was in a car with Jared Schurin of porno kitsch fame. And I happened to say this. I was like, oh, I have this funny idea for a novella, but no one's ever going to do anything with it because who the hell publishes novellas? And then he had, you know, sort of put us in touch because he knew you were doing this thing for Tor. This will be my first non-novel, I suppose.
That's exciting.
Yeah. I'm excited. I was really excited. I was thrilled when this whole thing came together. And I can remember being in my apartment and just laughing hysterically at the idea that someone is going to pay me for writing about animals murdering each other.
You know, if there's really any way to sell this better than that, I just don't think there is. I mean, I think that's the... you say you're not good at this self-promotion thing, Dan, but I see it.
Right, that's true. Maybe that'll be like, I'll change my Twitter handle so it's like Daniel Polansky, imaginary writer of imaginary animals killing each other.
Yeah. You mentioned a few minutes ago that you've written some travel essays, and you travel a lot.
I do, not as much as I used to, now that I have a couch out and things. But after I sold Lowtown, I pretty much just traveled for a couple of years.
Just like, I'm just going to take this advance and just travel?
That was basically
the influx of cash, I'm going to travel?
Yes, actually, I was already home. I'd sort of like I'd been like a vagabond for like 9 months before Lowtown got picked up. I was just kind of like wandering aimlessly on very little money, and then I got the advance, and I was like, great, I can keep doing this for a few more years. So,
did you write it all while you were traveling?
Books 2 and 3 of Lowtown while I was on the road.
I can't do anything when I'm not comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like traveling, like I was just at a work conference last week, and I have like 5 deadlines creeping up on me, but like I can't do anything unless I'm at home. Like, mm-hmm. I cannot, if I'm on the road, I'm in a hotel, like I can't get any work done. It's impossible.
So you have the George R. R. Martin kind of philosophy of writing then. Like if you're not in the perfect setting, the stuff won't flow.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not really a fiction writer, so maybe it's a little unique.
Lowtown was written, like the entire draft of Lowtown, I wrote with my boss's back, when my boss's back returned, basically. Back when I had a real job some 8 years ago. 7-8 years ago. So I think like that sort of trained me to, I don't know, I don't have that at all. I can write anywhere. And in fact, actually I tend to write better if there's a little bit of chaos kind of going on around me. And I kind of have to focus my energy against that, if that makes any sense. I don't know. I mean, I get more work done now being in one place, but I got all my stuff done when I was traveling, you know, and plus you're alone. I was always traveling alone. So, that you have a ton of solitude basically to get stuff done, even though there's people around you and, you know, maybe you're in a busy city or something like that. You don't know anybody, you know, you're still spending the majority of your days, you know, on buses or trains or hitchhiking alone or whatever. So, you know, there was just a lot of time to think about my own stuff. And I don't know, writing, even for people who practice it, I think writing is kind of a mystery. You don't really know why it happens or how you get it to work. But for me, I never had any trouble writing while I was traveling, except in India. India was really damn hard to write in, but I'm not in India anymore, so it doesn't really come up.
Was it India just too chaotic?
India was just too chaotic. India was just too much to comfortably get stuff done. Or, I mean, you know, sometimes if you're in a particularly kind of chaotic scenario or chaotic country, you know, you need to have your sort of your full energy dedicated towards that. But like, whatever, if you're just like on a, if you're in like the French countryside, like it's pretty easy to get a few thousand words out.
Did you go up into like China or Thailand or anything like that?
Yeah, well, I used to live in Taiwan years ago before I sold the book. But yeah, apart from that, I mean, I spent a fair bit of time in sort of Southeast Asia, Japan and China and Thailand, where else? Other places, Malaysia, different places. I can't think of them all right now.
Yeah, there's a weird kind of group of authors right now. Max Gladstone, Brian Staveley, yourself, apparently, now. And there are a few others who all wrote extensively in Asia, like Thailand and China and those sorts of places, which I think is interesting. I think it's because when you go to these places, you're really, as you say, you are really isolated. I mean, either there's a language barrier or there's or just a accessibility issue because you're in the middle of nowhere and don't have any easy way to get anywhere that you actually get a lot of work done.
Truthfully, I wrote a book because I wanted to go traveling. And then it turned out I really liked writing. And so I kind of just kept doing it. But so it's sort of like cart before the horse. But yeah, I mean, I found traveling to be like really good for my writing in the long term, especially. And a lot of little bits, you know, from both the Lowtown stuff and those above, you know, they're things you cribbed from strange moments that I was traveling or strange things that I saw here or there, or, you know, slums I walked through or pretty buildings I liked or that kind of thing. So I think it was really useful, you know, especially as a fantasy writer, you're trying, it's not the only thing you're going to do, but you're trying to capture some sort of sense of wonder for the reader. And that's something that you get very strong, I think, when you're traveling.
So, sense of wonder. So, like, Those Above has a great deal of wonder. It's this huge grand scale thing. You've got these, they're super beings, I guess.
Yeah.
And there's a great deal of sense of wonder there, especially with the sort of the hierarchies that you've created. But, like, I don't know, Lowtown is almost like an anti-sense of wonder.
That's true. That's true, actually. There's not that much wonder in Lowtown. Those Above, that kind of thing came out a lot more. I guess, actually, the stuff that I got from traveling for Lowtown was more like, you know, like walking through a slum in Delhi and just being like, wow, this is really not anything like how I pictured, you know, how my own life has been, the things that I've seen. But it's how a lot of the world lives, and it's how almost the entirety of the world lived, you know, in the West during the sort of Middle Ages analog or whatever. So I have a very vivid memory, and I think I worked this into the second book, into Tomorrow the Killing. I have this very vivid memory of walking through this you know, sort of slum in Delhi, and this street kid, there was like some dog eating it like a trough of waste, and this street kid like ran up and smacked him with a bamboo pole. And then like looked at me and laughed, and I was like, okay, that's going in the book.
And I'm already kind of seeing how these two series will be a little bit in conversation with one another, perhaps. It's always shifting, right? These things that we care about and the things that we're interested in talking about. And it feels like 10 years ago and into, you know, when maybe Lowtown was published, which was 4 or 5 years ago, I think now.
Yeah,
four years ago. We're having a lot of conversations sort of about, you know, authenticity, I guess, if you will, in fantasy, where it's like we've no more of these rose-colored glasses, no more of these, you know, Tolkien-esque inspired landscapes. Like, let's talk about the real shit that goes on in these worlds.
Right.
And it felt like that was, Lowtown was within that conversation. But then Those Above now, perhaps, and I think I'm seeing a lot other work like this that's now in conversation with that stuff, that's saying, okay, yeah, there is that. And then, but then they're almost coming back to the way things used to be, a little bit more of the high fantasy feel. As opposed to that deep grit and grime kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. You're probably right. I mean, this may not be true, but in my experience, you know, as a writer, it's really, really difficult to separate what you're doing from what is being done in larger parts of the genre. Or at least I have a lot of trouble with that. Maybe I won't broadly generalize. But I guess I would say, like, I tend to feel like when I talk to you or when I talk to other reviewers or bloggers or critics, they tend to have a keener sort of insight into the larger movement of the sort of tableau that maybe I tend to be missing because, you know, you're more focused on your own stuff. So what you're saying seems to make sense, but I frankly can't comment on it to any degree of intelligence.
So what's interesting about that is that writers, and I agree with you, are largely unaware of this entirely. And yet these movements do happen, right? I mean, if you look historically, you can see how movements have happened through different literature things.
Sure.
But how much of it does? It seems impossible that writers not paying attention to these movements would be writing to them. And it's almost like editors see the movements and pick the people that are writing in them, as opposed to you writing to a movement. I don't think people really ever understand that, but it seems to me that that's sort of like what the publishers control most of all is how the movements form.
That's very plausible. A funny conversation. Something else I'm working on, an unrelated project. It's sort of like it's not really an urban fantasy, but it's sort of something like this. And I happened to mention this to some editor and they were like, oh, no one buys urban fantasy anymore. What you've written is a contemporary fantasy. And it was like, great. That's great. This is really very helpful. Thanks a lot.
That is true. Yeah. Everybody's saying that right now. Everybody says nobody's buying urban fantasy. That is totally a thing that's being said.
You have to remember also there's a pretty long lag time between anything, you know, so it's like years go by before the books come out. You know, once something is kind of fully flowered, you're already a few years, you've already started a few years before that. So I think you're probably right in terms of editors, sort of publishers doing more with the landscape, or for that matter, readers. I mean, you know, they're the ones that are getting passionate about things. But at the same time, I mean, as I can say honestly, as a writer, I didn't sit down before Low Town and think like, I never heard of the word grimdark before Low Town came out. And I probably hadn't really read a lot of the other guys that would be described in that way, you know, and after it came out, people were like, oh, your books are like this guy's books or that guy's books. I could sort of see why they would say that. But, you know, there was never a conscious effort on my part to write narrowly within a sort of specific trend of modern fantasy.
Yeah, we all read the same stuff as kids, right? Generally.
Right.
And so that's what's informing the writing.
Right. I don't think any writer particularly likes to be compared to any other writer, to be very honest, would be my guess, because just, you know, arrogantly in your own mind, you think of this thing as being, you know, its own creation. And even if you can recognize on some other, you know, broader level, that's not true. It's still hard to kind of rid yourself of that idea. But I think it is true that probably a lot of us have read the same things, you know, so it's like, no, you know, I wasn't inspired by, I get like the Harry Dresden series to write Low Town. I hadn't read the Harry Dresden series. I didn't know what that was, but I had read Raymond Chandler and probably so is the guy who writes the Harry Dresden series, you know, or that kind of a thing. I mean, we've got probably similar influences and, you know. If something's powerful enough to push you in a certain direction, it probably was powerful enough to push other people in the same.
But we all know that anything Daniel Polansky has written is the best, because...
well, I mean, sure, I assume there was going to be a tag, like, beforehand that said that, you know, like you just were going to introduce me that way.
Hashtag the best.
Hashtag the best.
Hashtag the best.
I have that tattooed on my forehead, you know, Justin. It's been a few
is
months.
Is that right?
Together. Yeah, it's in big block letters.
I'll tell you what. When the Builders comes out, we'll hashtag the best, and that'll be the official publicity hashtag.
We should get matching the Builders tattoos.
Whoa! My wife would support this. You know, my wife really wants me to get a tattoo, like really badly.
I'm surprised you don't have a tattoo. Not that we know each other all that well, but like, you know, I sort of feel like you're like the last guy in the genre to not have a tattoo.
Yeah, I don't intentionally scarring my body. Like, I have enough scars from surgeries and stuff that I don't need to like add inked up ones.
Okay.
But my wife, when she turned 30, was like, I really want to have some tattoos. And I was like,
right.
All right. And so she went and had two tattoos done on the same night.
Wow.
And I know. And so she says, I think it'd be really sexy if you got a tattoo. I mean, she's like really putting it on hard. And I'm like, I don't want one, but
it's time to man up and, you know, like, get your wife this tattoo that she's looking for, man.
You know, right? Maybe. Do you think she would approve of a mouse with a?
I don't know. I think this is a conversation that really, like, you I don't want to get you like thrown out of the house, Justin. Like, maybe you should, you know, you talk to your wife about this. We'll see if we can't come up with kind of builder tattoo that's sexy enough for her, but, you know, like, still represents the essence of the book.
Like a badger with a Gatling gun. Like, I just
like a badger with a Gatling gun. But I think you should get like a full size badger with a Gatling gun on your back. And we'll see how your wife feels about that.
Reminds me of the G.I. Joe. Was it the G.I. Joe character who had the big anchor on his chest or the...
What do you mean the sailor?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a while since I was always more a Thundercats guy growing up. So my G.I. Joe knowledge is not that strong.
Funny you should mention Thundercats. We were at my parents' house and I took my family with me, obviously, and we were going through all my old toys.
Oh.
And my daughter found the Thundercats and she was really excited about it.
Of course she was. Your daughter has good taste.
And then she saw the Silverhawks and she was like, whatever. Those guys are weird. Yeah. I don't even remember any of their names.
I remember too many of their names.
If somebody...
No, I don't think I do. But it's easy though, because it was just like, you just added a vowel to the name of a great cat, you know? So it's like Lion-O, Tigra, Pantera. That's pretty close. Those were most, and then Snarf, of course, Snarf.
Do you think Pantera was like some weird homage to heavy metal?
Weren't all of those like shows made in Japan and then like badly redubbed?
Probably.
So I don't know what the Japanese were listening to in like 82 when they were writing this show or something, but I'm not sure that heavy metal had made its way over there.
Sam Sykes is writing a novel for Pathfinder.
Good for Sam.
Which is like a D&D tie-in. If somebody offered you the chance to write Thundercats tie-in, would you say yes?
Interesting. Yeah, man, I will write... If you ever knew, Justin, how many things I've written like that don't have my name on it, or, you know, like, I like money. So it's a pretty easy thing to, like, to get my attention if you wave a few dollar bills in my face. Which is to say, totally. I would totally write a... But, you know, it would have to be the right artistic model. You know, like, it would have to be really gritty. I want to get into the slums of the Thundercats universe. You know, like, what are the impoverished parts of this country looking like? You know, like, what kind of drugs are they addicted to? You know, I want to give a real in-your-face kind of version of this world. I remember nothing about Thundercats. The longer this conversation goes on, all I remember is that magic sword.
Well, it's like, who cleans the fucking litter boxes, right? I mean, what? Like, what's going on there?
Exactly. There's always... We need to make a Marxist critique of the Thundercats universe.
All right, I'm into that. Folks out there, if you're interested in a Thundercats tie-in remix, Daniel Polansky's your guy.
Right. Holler at me.
However, that has nothing to do with Those Above, which comes out next week. People can pre-order it at everywhere you can find books.
Yes, it is. It can be purchased as books are.
Daniel, thanks for coming on.
Thanks a ton for having me. It was great talking to you.
All right, this has been Rocket Talk.